Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
This program reflects the views and opinions of the participants. Guerrilla Radio, recorded February 19th and 21st, 2024. Well, despite his death in prison yesterday, Russian democracy activist Alexei Navalny will continue to serve his Western masters in their effort to unseat Vladimir Putin's government. Since the news broke, the Free Press has inundated the cybersphere airwaves and TVs of Europe and America with extollations of the man's courage and journalistic integrity, with testimonials coming from them in high places, those same silent on the bitter fate of Julian Assange, long dying but not dead yet in a British dungeon. Would it be too soon unkind to remember Navalny cosseted neo-fascists, was a performative if not demonstrable racist, and an asset of the CIA and MI6? Yes, the only thing worse than living in prison perhaps is dying there, and few deserve that. So rest in peace, Alexei, if you can find it. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. Principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, Helmer has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and has served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out, and his latest released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. Helmer has also written voluminously on Navalny, his activities, methods, goals, and sponsors. John Helmer in the first half. And Canadians largely still believe, despite clear and present evidence of complicity in coups, occupations, and conspiracies to profit from the misery foisted upon anonymous others in foreign lands, that we constitute a force for good in the world. This is perhaps nowhere more evident than in Palestine, where successive Canadian governments maintain vociferous and bipartisan support of the State of Israel, even while paying lip service to the unmet humanitarian needs of the captive populations of Gaza, Jerusalem, and the West Bank. Mazen al-Nahawi is a Palestinian refugee from Safad-occupied Palestine, a graduate of the Higher Institute of Dramatic Arts Criticism Department, Damascus, Syria, where he too studied Arab linguistics. Mazen now lives here in Victoria, land that is the traditional territory of the Lekwungen, Esquimalt, and Wasanich peoples. Mazen al-Nahawi and the fight for Palestine on two home fronts in the second half. But first, John Helmer and the use of Alexei Navalny in life and afterwards. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
Well, you know, it's my pleasure every time. Well, John, now Stella Assange tweeted out condolences to the family and friends of Alexei Navalny. She says, in addition to being an opposition figure, Navalny is, quote, his investigative journalism exposed the corruption of the ruling elites in Russia. John, is it fair to discount Navalny as simply a corrupted stooge of Western aims to destabilize Russia without recognizing his journalistic work?
One can recognize Alexei Navalny's investigative work for what it was and what it is. Like any investigative journalist, the test is the truthfulness of what he wrote. In his particular case, and I knew him a long, long time ago when he was an investigative journalist focusing on Gazprom and Rosneft and state oil and gas companies in Moscow. There are two issues about his so-called investigative work. The first thing is how truthful or how fabricated the particulars are of his reports. That's one issue. And I've spent a lot of time over the years commenting on that and analyzing that. The second thing is who he left out. Navalny's consistently shown that he has consistently aimed not to investigate the people behind him. These were, at the time, Dmitry Medvedev, when I first met Alexei Navalny, then prime minister, then president, because he was the U.S. Anglo-American candidate to run the country instead of Vladimir Putin. Second, he never touched the real culprits, the real destroyers of the Russian Economy, Anatoly Chubais, and Alexei Kudrin. Do we need to go into their names? The point I'm making is Navalny had a highly selective set of targets. They reflected a political agenda. And in time, he became a politician following a political agenda. And the investigative journalism was handmaiden to the politics and to his ambition. Handmaiden to ambition? What's that? I'd call that prostitution.
Well, the names might be important for people, and they probably won't be remembered by people on this side of the Atlantic, but I don't think there's many people in Canada and the United States in the press or in the political life that can name more than two or three Russians beyond Vladimir Putin. And this adds to the fact that to this myth that Vladimir Putin rules Russia alone as a czar-like figure. So I, yes. In that sense, I think, yeah, maybe the names are important. But do you think, John, that he was, I know that he was, first of all, tell us, what was he in prison for? And behind that, was he in prison for his journalistic work or his political opposition or something other?
He was in prison, convicted initially of civil fraud. He was then subsequently convicted of a range of political offenses, including extremism. He was never charged with treason. And the Russian criminal code allows the charge of treason for the sorts of things Navalny was doing. But let's focus on the fact that he's dead and that the world outside of Russia thinks this is very important in order to do what you just said, to demonize Putin, while the world inside Russia is paying no attention at all. A few hundred people close to Navalny have demonstrated, and they're getting maximum publicity in the West. But the real story, the real timing of this event, to put it in scale, to put it into Russian scale where it counts, is that Avdiivka has fallen on the line in the in Ukraine, and it's the beginning of the rout of the Ukrainian army and therefore of the Anglo-American NATO scheme to destroy Russia using the Ukraine. The Ukraine military are falling back. They're running away. They're surrendering with white flags. The casualty tolls this past several days have been approximately 1,000 men killed every day. This is terrible. It's the toll of the army, which is falling apart. That's the story in Russia. And the reason these people are being put there by Mr. Zelensky and the new commander of the Ukrainian army is to advertise that the regime in Kyiv is still capable of fighting on and deserves the billions of dollars President Biden wants to send them. Now, President Biden then expands against a Congress that's resisting. Who in the United States, who in the Pentagon really wants to admit this war is being lost, which it is being lost now? Who wants to admit to sending more money, good money after bad? The answer is nobody in their right mind wants to do this, so that the Navalny death comes coincidentally at the same time as the Biden administration has a real problem of support, of continuing U.S. support for a losing war. There are many coincidences, let's call them, in this matter, but reasoning from coincidence or association to cause of Navalny's death won't get us very far. I'd like to focus on what we know and what we have to know before we determine what actually happened.
Yeah, and I thought that $60 billion that Biden was trying to get through Congress, the Senate had already signed off on, I thought that was a slam dunk for him. And Zelensky, he's in Germany. He got a standing ovation at some defense contractors confab or security confab I saw on my Twitter feed just this morning.
Well, who wouldn't support, who wouldn't give a round of applause if you're Krauss Maffei or Rheinmetall or the other German arms manufacturers? Who wouldn't give a standing applause to the individual who is helping to generate rising share prices, rising market capitalization, rising bonuses. In fact, heaps of money flowing into those particular German pockets. Of course, they applaud the guy. Of course, there's another problem, and it's recognized by some of the generals in the Pentagon, certainly the chairman of the Joint Chief, the U.S. Air Force, General Brown, that losing a war is very bad for the arms business. And having your best tank, having your best anti-aircraft defense missile system, whether it's the German Leopard or the U.S. Patriot system, are annihilated, defeated, are liquidated on the battlefield in combat is a very bad advertisement for arms sales and ultimately will affect the U.S. and German and Anglo-French arms manufacturers. But this war is a short-term business as well as a long-term business. And one's share price today, one's bonus tomorrow, one's market capitalization for the next quarter, those are the things these folks are aiming at, not to mention the coming German election, the coming US election, and so on. It won't matter what they put into the Ukraine now. It won't matter that the French have promised to deliver Mirage 2000s, but they will never be delivered. It won't matter that the US F-16 has been promised to fly against the Russian Air Force. What's happening now is the collapse of the Ukrainian forces along the line. And that will be followed by the destruction of the war infrastructure that NATO and the US have built all the way to the Polish border. Just how far the Russian offensive, which is now beginning in each pocket, each direction of the line of contact, how far they will go, what the political shape of the new Kievan landlocked state will be, whether it'll be focused around Lvov on the Polish border or around Kiev in the center of the country, remains to be seen. But this is the big picture, and nothing will make any difference to the war on the ground. But we're also talking about the war of words. The war of words, the propaganda warfare that has used Alexei Navalny's death on Friday is a different kind of war. In the propaganda war, the Anglo-American side are very good at what they do. Very good. Against them, the Russian propaganda warfare machine is much worse. It's failed to make a significant dent on the credibility of such baloney stories as Litvinenko was poisoned by Russian polonium back in 2006. It's failed to make a dent on the credibility of the story that Russian Novichok attacked Sergei and Yulia Skripal in 2018 and subsequently killed Dawn Sturgis in Wiltshire in 4 months later. It failed to make a dent, Russian PR, on Navalny's allegations the first time round that he'd been poisoned by Novichok in Tomsk in August 2020. The PR war, however, is not the real war. The real war between Russia, NATO, and the United States is being won by soldiers. The PR war can be won by the New York Times, the Times of London, Rupert Murdoch, or the rest. And it will likely create the immortality of Alexei Navalny as a PR hero, just as it did Litvinenko, but forever. But it doesn't. Ultimately, we've got a military war and a propaganda war. So the way in which one fights a propaganda war has to be put in scale. It's much smaller in significance than the military one. It's connected to the military one. It keeps arms manufacturers, as you suggested, Chris, it keeps in money, in bonuses, in rising market capitalization. It keeps demented presidents in office. It keeps political parties hopeful of winning office, and so on and so on and so on. I'm saying the obvious.
Speaking of Biden, well, he said of Navalny, he said even in prison, he was a powerful voice for the truth, and he seems to be even a more powerful voice in death with von der Leyen and the rest all pointing the fingers at Putin for his murder, Boris Johnson, saying there's nobody is allowed to harbor any doubts, I'm paraphrasing, that it was Putin that did this. Putin and Putin, Putin is all we're hearing over here in the press. And this is being used to rev people up. And as I think, frankly, a distraction for what the horror going on in Gaza right now as well. But the idea is that they can really get things going again, like they did with the Novichok fiascos that you mentioned.
I don't disagree, Chris. It took Litvinenko died in London in November 2006. It took almost 10 years before the public inquiry, not a coronial inquest, produced the finding that Russia had killed him with polonium poisoning. 10 years. It's so far taken almost 6 years for the alleged Novichok attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal and Dawn Sturges to have reached public inquiry stage. And it will take another year or two, maybe 8 years in all, before Russia will be blamed for those alleged poisonings. The method's obvious. First, you blame Russia, and then you spend years assembling the evidence. If the evidence doesn't fit, it never fitted in any of these cases. But let's not rehash the old ones. Let's focus on Alexei Navalny. Alexei Navalny was not poisoned by Novichok. It wasn't in his cup of tea in the Tomsk airport. It wasn't in his hotel bedroom blue-colored water bottle, and it wasn't in his underpants. Alexei Navalny suffered a seizure from the chemical poisonings that were in his bloodstream, in his urine, and in his hair, as discovered and reported in print by the civilian hospital Charité in Berlin, and then reported in published in The Lancet, and then subsequently announced by some of the doctors and some of the witnesses I assembled. He was a lithium and benzodiazepine addict. He triggered the collapse that has been associated with Novichok himself, either knowingly or by overdosing. He was revived in the Omsk hospital. He was then measured and tested in Germany, and the evidence of Novichok has never appeared in the chemical record. It's a press release. A press release repeated in Sweden, in France, and of course, since Putin had been blamed to begin with, the press releases appear to corroborate it. In the archive that readers or listeners can look up on Navalny on my website, there is more than 60 articles looking at the biochemical evidence and the rest. But it doesn't count, does it? The believability is in the first remark. Johnson against the Russians against Skripal. Never mind that the Skripals could testify if they were alive, that it wasn't.
Officially, they still are alive, though, right?
I believe Sergei Skripal is dead. I believe Yulia Skripal is alive. But we've talked about that before. It's another subject. Let's go to the question. What we do know is Alexei Navalny is now dead. The question then becomes, what caused his death? And people who don't follow cause of death, as it's tested in the courts of Canada, of the United States, and of Great Britain, don't understand the subtlety. When the Federal Penitentiary Service of Russia announced his death, the last line has totally escaped everybody's attention. Excuse me for being a bit excited, but I'm trying to emphasize, look at the last line of the official announcement. The causes of death are being established. That's what the Federal Penitentiary Service said. The key word there is causes, plural. What does that mean? It means that there's what is known in coronial court practice in the UK as the proximal cause might be cardiac arrest, it might be brain injury, it might be a thrombosis in the lung. The way to establish that is by sophisticated scanning machines or by old-fashioned autopsy, opening up the body and checking. The evidence of a heart attack is very easy to see. The evidence of a brain aneurysm, a blood clot that's gone to the brain, is very easy to see. There are pools of blood in the brain. Children should leave the room if this is
if they're squeamish.
Topic. The point is that proximal or cause 1A, as it's often written in a British coroner's report on cause of death, is what kills, what stops breathing, what ends life. The question, is there a prior precedent cause of cause? What caused the heart attack? What caused the brain aneurysm? What caused the lungs to stop breathing, feeding oxygen, and so on? In the case of the death of Dawn Sturgis, the alleged Novichok fatality, the initial cause, cardiac arrest and hypoxic brain injury, cause 1A, was changed after several months by another pathologist to read Novichok toxicity. In other words, it took the British months to add Novichok as the cause of the brain or heart attack injury that killed Dawn Sturgis. What can happen in Alexei Navalny's case now that everybody in the allied side of the Ukrainian war against Russia has announced that Russia poisoned him, killed him? Answer, first you have to have very sophisticated toxicology to see what was in his system, what was in Alexei Navalny's system when he collapsed. Second, you need very sophisticated scanning machines, or you need open autopsy, but either way, you need very considerable pathologist skill. That's not available in the local jail hospital. The machines and the testing sophistication are not readily available in many advanced cities. You can bet your life they're not available in the Yamalo-Nenets region. So that Russia, the Russian government, the penitentiary service, has to do a very sophisticated testing to determine what Navalny was taking before death. Now, we know, this isn't in the Navalny team's press releases. It's never been admitted by the family that he had preceding serious medical conditions. We also know from the German clinical evidence he was heavily dependent on lithium and benzodiazepines. Now, suppose that the Russian medical system was allowing Navalny to stay on a benzodiazepine drug, and suppose to deal with anxiety, sleeplessness, and many of the symptoms you'd associate with being in prison and in solitary as he was, suppose he was taking a sedative. The combination of some sedatives that are popular among Russian neurologists and doctors with a benzodiazepine, which are also popular treatment among Russian doctors, that combination can kill. It's well documented in US medical literature. It works by causing the liver enzyme that breaks down the residue of the combination of these drugs in such a way that the liver enzyme ceases to work. And when that happens, you've got a very serious possibility of massive heart attack. On the other hand, we know that Navalny was vaccinated, possibly with boosters, by an mRNA drug, whether it was Pfizer or another, we don't know. It happened in Germany. And we also know, though it's not popular to admit it, and it's becoming illegal to say so in France, that one of the long COVID effects of that type of vaccination with boosters can trigger blood clotting that's fatal. So if there was a vaccination effect, a COVID vaccination effect, not a popular theory and not a popular line of investigation to be published, then that could have caused the sudden death we know Navalny has suffered. Either way, it's much too soon to be blaming anybody at all. The media want to say now, and what I'm saying is it's going to be very difficult and time-consuming and expertise-consuming on the Russian side to produce results. But we already know that whatever results they will publish, if they publish them in full, will be ignored, just the way the Omsk hospital results were ignored in Navalny's first round.
Now we're coming down to the break. You and I are going to continue speaking, and the extended conversation can be found at guerrilla-radio.com and up at the Substack site as well. But for this version, and for the version for listeners over at CJSF, Simon Fraser University Radio, we're going to take a break, and I'll be back after the break with Mazen Al-Nahawi. So for this version, John, thanks a lot, and reminding everybody, if we've got you right on the edge of your seat and just waiting for the next shoe to drop, then go to guerrilla-radio.com. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Chris.
Escape the narrative. Guerrilla Radio.
Congress and the Bundestag, you'll see them wring their hands and say how they wish in hindsight they had tried to understand, how they wish they'd seen the warning signs and heard the generals speak and believed them when they talked about the vengeance they would wreak, how they should have known this was not idle conversation, how they should have listened harder when they said elimination. Yes, once it's all too late and the graveyards are all filled, once the last Palestinians killed. On Manhattan Island, in the halls of the UN, the whole world will come together to say never again. They'll open a museum full of relics of the past before those who used to live there resisted to the last. We'll look at pictures of the rubble with the dead limbs poking through. The viewers will shed a tear and wish the leaders knew before the war ended in the way Ben-Gavir had willed, once the last Palestinians killed. In the parliament, they'll say, perhaps we should have listened instead of purging Europe's biggest party of internal opposition. Should have paid attention to the millions in the streets, to those massive crowds around the globe voting with their feet. Should have read the signs, should have listened to their words instead of denouncing all the talk of genocide is just absurd. Should have looked at the pictures of the bodies charred and grilled, once the last Palestinians killed. When that last tower block was flattened, in the days before the last bakery was bombed, in this total war, when there were still kindergartens, when the hospital still stood, this would have been the time to question if we should have been sending all those weapons instead of barring them complete. If instead of cheering on the evil enemy's defeat, we might have asked if there was anywhere left for flour to be milled, once the last Palestinians killed. When the project is complete and they make the desert bloom, once they finish.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, Canadians largely still believe, despite clear and present evidence of complicity in coups, occupations, and conspiracies to profit from the misery foisted upon anonymous others in foreign lands, that we constitute a force for good in the world. This is perhaps nowhere more evident than in Palestine, where successive Canadian governments maintained vociferous and bipartisan support of the State of Israel, even while paying lip service to the unmet humanitarian needs of the captive populations of Gaza, Jerusalem, and the West Bank. Mazen Al-Nahawi is a Palestinian refugee from Safad-occupied Palestine, a graduate of the Higher Institute of Dramatic Arts Criticism Department, Damascus, Syria, where he too studied Arab linguistics. Mazen now lives here in Victoria, land that is the traditional territory of the Kangwin, Esquimalt, and Wasanich peoples. Mazen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Chris, for having me, and thanks for everybody listening and giving me a chance to speak about this subject.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course, and it's been too long since we spoke. It's been more than 10 years, in fact. Mazen, in mid-November of last year, the Israeli Security Cabinet member Avi Dichter said, quote, "We are now rolling out the Gaza Nakba 2023. That's how it'll end." satellite pictures have confirmed that there are structures being built by the Egyptians at a furious pace in the Sinai. Mazen, how does the catastrophe of 1948 compare with what we're seeing today? What